I'm a biologist. For the past 4 months, I've been part of an international research team stationed in one of the most isolated parts of the Arctic. The mission was simple enough. Study ancient ice layers to reconstruct historical climate patterns. Important work, sure, but not the kind of thing you expect to haunt you. Our team had 10 people. Geologists, glaciologists, biologists like me, and technicians to keep everything running. We were equipped with state-of-the-art drilling rigs, spectrometers, and thermal imaging systems. The station itself was a prefab structure, perched on miles of endless white tundra. Outside, the air could freeze your skin in seconds, and the wind howled like it wanted to tear the building apart. Inside, it was the constant noise, the hum of the machinery, the chatter of comms, and, when the ice shifted beneath us, a low, resonant groaning that rattled through the floors. Despite all the tech, the work wasn't glamorous. My job was to analyze any organic material we pulled from the ice cores. Ancient pollen, microbial remnants, that sort of thing. Most days were just cataloging and running samples under the microscope while the rest of the team drilled. The monotony of it all weighed on us. Sleep was broken into short shifts, and the lack of sunlight messed with our circadian rhythms. People started snapping at each other over little things, whose turn it was to cook, why someone didn't clean up their workstation. It was subtle at first, but you could feel the tension simmering. One of the geologists, Dr. Harris, was particularly on edge. He kept saying the ice felt wrong. He'd run his hand along the drill cores, muttering about how dense it was or how it didn't fracture the way it should. Most of us brushed it off as stress. After all, you don't get to pick who you're stuck with on these expeditions, and Harris was the type to find something to complain about. But then, a few days ago, something changed. We'd been drilling deeper than we ever had before, almost 2 kilometers into the ice sheet. The core samples from that depth were pristine, layered with tiny air bubbles trapped for tens of thousands of years. It was a gold mine for climate data. And then, the drill hit something. I remember the way everyone froze when the rig operator called it out. At that depth, there shouldn't have been anything but ice, but the drill head had stopped cold. The team pulled the core up cautiously, and when we saw what was embedded in it, even Harris went quiet. It was a massive block of ice, denser than anything we'd encountered. Inside was something dark. A shape just barely visible. It wasn't clear enough to identify, but it was large, much larger than any organic material we'd expected. My first thought was that we'd hit a tree, maybe a fragment of ancient forest preserved in the ice. Harris, though, was pale as a sheet. "This doesn't belong here," he said. "We shouldn't dig it out." Of course, we didn't listen. Curiosity outweighs common sense in our field more often than not. That's why we were out here in the first place. We extracted the ice block with surgical precision, using the station's gantry crane to lift it from the drill site and transport it to the lab. The thing was massive, roughly the size of a sunken trunk, and impossibly dense. Harris argued against bringing it inside, but the rest of us were too intrigued. This was a once-in-a-lifetime find. Something buried beneath 2 kilometers of ice shouldn't exist, let alone pulse faintly in the cold. In the lab, we used controlled thermal plates to slowly melt the outer layers of ice, keeping the temperature just above freezing to preserve whatever was inside. The work took hours, and we all rotated shifts, logging every detail meticulously. When the ice thinned enough to see through, the shape became clearer. A heart. I can't describe the unease that hit me when I first realized what I was looking at. It wasn't a human heart. It was too large, about the size of a basketball, and the surface was rough and blackened like charred wood. But it was unmistakably organic, with thick, vein-like structures webbing across its surface. And the strangest part? It was beating. Slowly, faintly, but undeniably alive. Dr. Walker was the first to speak. "What the hell are we looking at?" No one answered. Harris muttered under his breath and left the room. The rest of us hovered around the observation table, staring in stunned silence as the heart pulsed in slow, deliberate rhythms. We ran every test you could think of. Thermal imaging showed no heat signature. It was as cold as the ice it had been trapped in. Scans with a spectrometer revealed no identifiable cellular structure, nothing remotely resembling DNA. It didn't even register as organic matter by conventional standards. And yet, the rhythmic contradictions continued, steady and unyielding, like a clock ticking down to something. Walker wanted to escalate. "This could redefine biology," she said, pacing the room. "We're looking at something older than humanity itself, maybe older than life as we know it." Harris, on the other hand, was livid. He stormed back into the lab at one point, slamming his hand on the table. "You're not listening," he shouted. "This isn't a discovery. It's a warning. We shouldn't be poking at it." No one took him seriously, myself included. I told myself he was cracking under the pressure. 4 months of isolation can mess with anyone's head. But part of me couldn't shake the feeling that he might be right. That night, after the others had gone to bed, I stayed behind in the lab, staring at the thing in its containment chamber. The heartbeat was faint, but it had a strange resonance to it, almost like it was echoing through the room. I thought I was imagining it, but when I left to get some air in the main corridor, I could still hear it, faint and rhythmic, like it was coming from the walls. I didn't sleep much that night. Every time I closed my eyes, I heard it. The steady, unrelenting thud of something ancient and alive. Something that shouldn't exist. The next step was to transfer the heart into a custom containment chamber. The lab had an isolation tank we usually used for volatile samples, complete with temperature controls, reinforced glass, and a HEPA filtration system. It wasn't designed for something alive, or whatever this thing was, but it would have to do. As we worked, I couldn't shake the feeling that it was watching us. It didn't have eyes, thank God, but every time I glanced at it, the beat seemed intentional, like it was aware of us. That's impossible, of course, just my mind playing tricks. At least, that's what I kept telling myself. We ran every test imaginable. Harris protested, but Walker overruled him. Samples were taken and analyzed. Thin slices of tissue, microfluidic tests, even a spectroscopic scan to identify its chemical makeup. The results made no sense. One sample showed isotropic signatures consistent with ancient biological material, something preserved for millions of years. Another indicated it was practically new, no more than a few weeks old. Harris refused to even look at the results. "You're asking the wrong questions," he muttered, pacing the room like a caged animal. "You're trying to explain something that doesn't belong here." I wanted to argue, but I couldn't ignore what was happening around us. The station's equipment started acting up. Our spectrometers gave inconsistent readings, the cryo-freezer alarm went off without reason, and the atmospheric monitors kept resetting to zero. The worst was the temperature. Despite the heaters being cranked to their max, the lab was freezing, and frost started forming on the windows. We checked for leaks, recalibrated everything, but nothing worked. Then came the dreams. It started with Walker. She mentioned one morning that she had a nightmare about a vast, pulsating shadow beneath the ice. The next day, Harris admitted he dreamt the same thing. By the third night, even I couldn't sleep without seeing it. This infinite, breathing darkness that felt like it was pulling me under. I brushed it off as stress. That's what scientists do, right? Rationalize, control the narrative. But Harris was losing it. He outright refused to go near the heart anymore. "You need to destroy it," he hissed at Walker during one of our meetings. "This isn't science, it's something else." "Something else?" she shot back. "You're being ridiculous." "Am I? Look around you. You think it's a coincidence the station's falling apart, that we're all having the same damn dream?" No one answered him, but the room felt heavier after that. One night, I stayed late in the lab, reviewing footage from the containment chamber. The camera we set up had been recording non-stop since the heart was transferred. At first, it was just more of the same. Slow, steady beats, a faint shimmer of condensation on the glass. But as I skipped through the timestamps, something caught my eye. The thudding sound. It wasn't random. I cross-referenced the audio with environmental data from the station. Every time someone entered the room, the heart's beats became stronger, faster. It wasn't just alive. It was reacting to us. I sat back, staring at the screen as the realization sank in. The thing wasn't just pulsing. It was waiting. The breaking point came when Dr. Walker finally decided enough was enough. "We're scientists," she said, her voice strained but resolute. "But we're also human, and we have limits. This thing is beyond them." It was the first time anyone openly acknowledged the dread we'd all been feeling. Even Harris, who had been spiraling into paranoia for days, nodded in grim agreement. For the first time, we all seemed united in a singular purpose: to end this. The plan was straightforward. We'd use the station's high-temperature furnace, normally reserved for incinerating biohazardous waste, to destroy the heart completely. The furnace could reach temperatures upwards of 1500 degrees Celsius, enough to obliterate organic material to ash. Nothing would survive that, not even this monstrosity. The preparation was meticulous. Walker insisted on strict protocol, and for once, no one questioned her. We wore our full protective gear, thermal gloves, lab coats and goggles, despite the bitter cold still permeating the station. The heart was carefully transferred into a reinforced steel container, then wheeled to the furnace room on a trolley. Harris kept his distance, his eyes darting nervously to the chamber's glass windows, as if expecting the heart to leap out at him. I focused on the equipment, double-checking the furnace's settings and ensuring the failsafes were active. It was a model I was familiar with, a robust, industrial-grade incinerator designed for extreme reliability. The digital display glowed faintly in the dim light, and I felt a small, fleeting sense of control. We had this. As the heart was placed into the furnace, I couldn't help but notice how it seemed still. The pulsing had stopped entirely, almost as if it knew what was coming. My rational mind told me it was just coincidence, a mechanical process, nothing more. But a small, irrational part of me wondered if it was holding its breath. Walker closed the furnace door with a finality that echoed in the silent room. She turned to me, nodding once. "Start it." I pressed the button, and the machine roared to life. Flames burst within the chamber, visible through the small observation window. The heart was engulfed in an instant, its dark, unnatural mass consumed by the fire. It felt like I had lifted my head out of water. The oppressive thudding sound vanished. The sudden silence felt deafening. Harris let out a shaky laugh, a sound that teetered between relief and hysteria. "It's over," he muttered. "It's finally over." Even I felt a glimmer of hope. The tension that had gripped the station for so long seemed to lift, replaced by a tentative sense of calm. We stayed there for what felt like hours, watching the furnace's temperature hold steady, ensuring nothing remained but ash. As the flames died down, the furnace's sensors confirmed total incineration. Walker turned to the team with a weary smile. "It's done. Let's get some rest." For the first time in days, I believed her. I woke to the sound of something crashing so loudly, it felt like the entire station had collapsed. The air was freezing, colder than it had any right to be indoors, and I could see my breath hanging in the dim emergency lighting. My heart pounded as I grabbed my flashlight and threw on my coat, ignoring the trembling in my hands. The noise had come from the lab. I ran, slipping slightly on the icy patches forming on the floor. By the time I reached the lab door, I already knew something was terribly wrong. The air felt thicker, heavier, and there was a faint, rhythmic sound coming from inside. A sound I hadn't heard since we destroyed the heart. Thud, thud, thud. The lab was in ruins. The containment chamber, which we'd used to study the heart, was shattered. Thick steel walls bent outwards as if something inside had pushed its way out. Equipment lay strewn across the floor, monitors blinking erratically. In the center of the room, sitting in a pool of what I could only hope wasn't blood, was the heart. It was vibrant now, an unnatural crimson that almost glowed in the dim light. It pulsed steadily, stronger than before, the sound so loud I could feel it reverberating in my chest. My breath caught in my throat as I stepped closer, my flashlight trembling in my grip. "This isn't possible," I whispered. My mind scrambled for answers. Could it have been a hallucination, a shared delusion? Had we somehow failed to destroy it? But no. There were the ashes, still inside the furnace, undeniable proof of what we'd done. And yet, here it was. The sound of glass shattering behind me made me spin around. Harris stood there, wild-eyed, clutching a piece of broken equipment in one hand. "We should have left it alone," he hissed. You all had to push, didn't you? You had to know. Harris, calm down, I said, my voice shaking. We don't know what's happening. We'll figure it out. Figure it out? He laughed, a harsh, grating laugh. You don't get it. It's not just the heart. It's connected to something. Something alive. I opened my mouth to argue, but he cut me off, stepping closer, his face inches from mine. You felt it, haven't you? The dreams, the cold. It's not just in our heads. It's broadcasting. Calling. His words hit me like a punch to the gut. The dreams. I knew exactly what he was talking about. The endless void, the sense of something massive shifting just out of sight beneath the ice. I wanted to believe it was stress, my brain playing tricks on me. But the way Harris looked at me, desperate and unhinged, made me wonder if it wasn't something more. Harris, I said carefully, you're not making sense. What are you saying? He pointed a shaking finger at the heart. That thing isn't just an organ. It's a beacon. It's waking something up. A cold chill ran down my spine. I glanced at the heart, its steady thudding now feeling more like a countdown than a pulse. The air grew colder, and the lights flickered ominously. Harris snapped. He grabbed a metal stool and hurled it across the room, smashing a monitor in a shower of sparks. We're doomed, he screamed. We're nothing but ants digging into a mountain. And now it knows we're here. Stop, I shouted, trying to grab him, but he shoved me away. He picked up another piece of equipment and began smashing it against the lab bench. The noise was deafening, echoing through the room and mixing with the relentless thud of the heart. Harris, get a grip! Walker's voice rang out as she burst into the lab, her face pale but resolute. We need to focus. We can fix this. Harris froze, staring at her like she'd just spoken in another language. Then he dropped the broken equipment, his shoulders sagging. It's too late, he whispered. It's already awake. The lights flickered again, and the rhythmic thudding grew louder, almost deafening. This time, it wasn't just the heart. It was coming from beneath our feet. The station had never felt so hostile. The air was so cold it hurt to breathe, and frost crept up from the walls like a living thing. My breath fogged in the weak emergency lighting as the temperature plummeted far below what our heaters could handle. The lights flickered in and out, casting the lab in a strobe-lit chaos. Every few seconds, the ice beneath us groaned like a wounded animal. And through it all, the heart beat faster, louder, syncing perfectly with the tremors beneath our feet. Dr. Walker's voice cut through the chaos, barking orders. We're not running. We contain it again, now. No, Harris shouted, backing toward the door, his eyes wild. You're insane. It's too late. If we stay, we're dead. I hesitated, caught between them. Walker's confidence was resolute, almost comforting. But Harris looked like he'd already seen the end. His fear was infectious. I wanted to bolt, to run as far as I could. But some part of me couldn't let go. The questions, the impossibility of the heart, it had dug into my mind, and I couldn't leave without understanding. I'm with Walker, I said, forcing the words through the lump in my throat. Harris shot me a look of pure disbelief before turning and bolting into the hallway. Walker grabbed my arm. Let's move, she said, pulling me toward the containment chamber. We seal it. That's the only way. The heart lay in the center of the lab, pulsating like a drumbeat that vibrated through my bones. Walker and I worked quickly, moving in a mechanical rhythm born of pure adrenaline. We pushed the shattered remnants of the containment chamber out of the way and hauled out a secondary unit, a smaller, less robust chamber meant for biological samples. It wasn't ideal, but it was all we had. "Temperature regulation first," Walker said, her voice trembling but steady. I nodded and grabbed the control panel, fumbling with the calibration dials. The unit hummed to life, and I felt a flicker of hope. Maybe we could fix this. Maybe it wasn't too late. But then, the ice screamed. There's no other word for it. A high-pitched, bone-deep sound echoed through the station as the floor beneath us cracked violently. I staggered, nearly losing my grip on the containment panel. Walker cursed and grabbed the edge of the bench for support. The heart's rhythm changed. It wasn't erratic or panicked. It was intentional, calculated. Each beat seemed to match the tremors beneath us, growing louder, faster. I glanced at Walker, and for the first time, I saw fear in her eyes. "We need to hurry," she said, her voice tight. Shadows danced on the walls, flickering unnaturally in the failing light. They moved like smoke, twisting and shifting into shapes I couldn't comprehend. For a moment, I swore one of them looked at me, though it had no eyes, no face, just a void that radiated malice. "We've got it," Walker shouted as we locked the chamber seals. The heart was contained again, its pulsations muffled but still deafening. Relief washed over me for a split second, but then the lab floor heaved violently, throwing us to the ground. The fissure opened without warning. A jagged, gaping maw split the lab in two, swallowing equipment and debris into an impossibly dark void. The containment chamber teetered on the edge, the heart's beats echoing louder and faster like a countdown. And then, it fell. Everything went still. The heart sound disappeared, leaving a silence so profound it felt like a vacuum. I thought it was over. I thought we'd stopped it. But then, the noise began. It wasn't a heartbeat. It wasn't anything I could truly describe. A low, resonant sound rumbled from the depths of the fissure, shaking the walls and vibrating in my chest. It wasn't just a noise. It was a presence. Something enormous, something alive was down there, stirring in the darkness. Walker and I locked eyes. She didn't say anything. She didn't have to. We both knew. The heart wasn't the thing. It was just a piece of it. The station felt like it was being ripped apart. Every step sent shockwaves through my body as the ice beneath us heaved and groaned. Walker and I scrambled out of the lab, the containment chamber and the heart long gone, swallowed into the abyss. The fissure stretched through the main hallway now, fracturing the floor and walls, as if the station itself was being consumed. We found Harris in the control room, frantically packing a bag with whatever supplies he could grab. His wild eyes locked on mine as he hissed, I told you we never should have touched it. There was no time to argue. Walker grabbed the emergency satellite beacon from the wall while I snagged a handheld radio, though I knew it was useless in the storm outside. We bolted for the airlock, barely managing to pull on our cold weathered gear before stepping into the howling blizzard. The wind hit like a freight train, stinging every exposed inch of skin and reducing visibility to a few feet. The station was a fading silhouette behind us, its lights flickering like a dying signal. We trudged forward, relying on muscle memory to navigate toward the secondary outpost a few kilometers away. That's when the ground shook again. Different this time. It wasn't the random shuddering of ice under strain. It was rhythmic, deliberate. I risked a glance back, and through the swirling snow, I saw something moving. It was massive, indescribable. The ice itself seemed to ripple and bulge as if something enormous was swimming beneath it, displacing the frozen landscape with each movement. I froze, my breath catching in my throat, but Walker yanked me forward. "Keep moving," she shouted over the wind. We stumbled into the outpost hours later, half frozen and barely coherent. Harris collapsed against the wall, muttering incoherently about shadows and whispers. Walker and I managed to activate the backup generator and send a distress signal. Then, we waited. Rescue didn't come for 3 days. By the time the team arrived, the storm had passed, leaving the Arctic wasteland eerily quiet. When we tried to lead them back to the station, we found nothing. The site where it had stood was now a featureless expanse of ice, as though the building itself had been erased. There was no debris, no signs of the fissure, just smooth, undisturbed snow stretching endlessly in every direction. Back at base camp, I filed my report. I included everything. The heart, the containment chamber, the tremors, and the impossible creature beneath the ice. I even uploaded the fragmented video logs from the station, though they were distorted and beyond recognition. The official response came weeks later. My account was dismissed as stress-induced delusions brought on by isolation and environmental conditions. Harris quit the project entirely, retreating to his family in the south. Walker stayed on, but she wouldn't speak to me after the debrief. I could see the guilt in her eyes. She blamed herself, though I knew none of us could have known what we were waking up. As for me, I thought I could move on. But I was wrong. The dream started a month later. At first, they were just fragments, dark shapes beneath the ice, the sound of faint thudding in the distance. Then, they became more vivid. I was back in the lab, staring at the heart as it pulsed stronger and faster, the shadows on the walls growing darker, deeper. The worst part is the sound, that rhythmic thudding. It's with me all the time now. Sometimes I hear it in my apartment, soft but insistent, like it's calling to me. I don't know what we awakened beneath the ice. I don't know if it's still there or if it's already spreading. But I do know one thing. We were never meant to find it. And it's not done yet.